opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good afternoon. Welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. It's the don't mind that struggle in the background. It's just part of the fun. Is everybody okay?
Yeah, I'm all right.
Okay.
I'm back.
So my name's Aaron Ryan.
And Bill Cundiff.
And Bob Martin.
So between the three of us, we're going to give you 2 hours of fun
radio. I like
radio.
How you refer to it as an episode. It's like reality TV.
Yeah, it's an episode. Well, as opposed to having an episode.
I have episodes every once in a while.
And, it's kind of where I was headed. That's,
you have to do that. Kind of clears you out a little bit.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, a good episode will do a body good. So today we're talking. Today's going to be interesting, actually. And so I figure we'll have a segment of people who will kind of freak out and think that we're being whatever. But this would not be a politically correct show on a good day.
I've been accused of being whatever many times.
I know. I had a variety of things. I thought I'd just lump them all under the category of whatever.
Whatever.
We have Elaine Willman on with us today. And hold on here. Let me get the book so I read the subtitle correctly. The name of her book is Going to Pieces, The Dismantling of the United States of America. So you're probably thinking we're going to talk about, you know, voting and politics and candidates and stuff, but not today. Today we're going to talk about tribalism and what's happening with our Indian tribal policy. She'll, of course, have all the proper lingo, but just so you know, she's a mom and a grandma, and her mom and her grandma were enrolled Cherokee members. Her spouse is of Shoshone ancestry, and little fact here. He's a direct descendant of Sacagawea.
Wow.
I know. Like, harken back to what, sixth grade? When do you learn about Sacagawea? Like, elementary school
something
when you're
like that,
building
yeah.
dioramas? She serves as the national chair of Citizens Equal Rights Alliance and did that from 2001 to 2007. Remains an active SARA board member. And she has blended her local land use and strategic planning expertise with federal Indian policy. And the purpose of that was to inform, engage counties, towns, and citizens that are co-located within or near federally recognized Indian reservations. I think you'll be surprised at how much this affects you. So, you know, there's always a segment of people out there thinking, I don't think I care about this, and I don't think it has anything to do with me. Well, if you're a taxpayer, you should keep listening. We try not to do topics that don't affect large numbers of people, and bottom line is, if you're a taxpayer, this is coming out of your pocket, and you should, it's kind of hidden, I guess. Bill's typing, so he can't speak.
Oh, sorry. Sorry. I told my mom never to text me during the radio show, and I felt compelled. Darn mom. Like, not really.
I could have to poke you with this pen, am I?
Yeah. Yeah, you will.
So you read the stuff yesterday.
I did read it. And it was funny. It was an angle I'd never thought of before. As a country, we go overseas and we fight, you know, wars over countries that are tribal in nature, and we try to bring them democracy and teach them about democracy. And little did I know that in this country we promote tribalism, just the opposite.
We're going backwards.
Yeah, we're going backwards, and it was interesting.
And for those of you that are concerned that our Constitution is being run over, ignored, or however,
just basically ignored.
Yeah, this is operating outside our Constitution. So we literally have United States citizens
that are not our. Maybe they don't want to be.
They have the protection of the Constitution,
right?
But they get to have their own
tribal
own
laws
government.
As well.
Yeah, their own government, and we pay for all that. So anyway, with that nutty introduction, Bob, do you have anything to add there?
Elaine sure has a lot of fans in Montana that are trying to hear the show right now.
Oh, is that what's going on? I know you were over there. I'm like, what are you? Bob's become Ernestine the operator.
Oh, there's another one.
That's pretty interesting. So you can find a ton of information, information about the book and all that and about Elaine at wethepeopleradio.us. And there's a link there for her book. There also is a link to a News with Views article. I'm sure some other stuff will come up, and we'll link that as we go. But I think you'd be surprised to know that there are, I've got a little clip from the book here, that at least 90 major public spaces and natural resources, including Redwood National Monument in California and Joshua Tree National Monument in California, are targeted by the Department of the Interior, the Bureau of Land Management, Bureau of Reclamation, the National Park Service, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife to be turned over to private tribal governments. The list includes 41 national refuges, 34 national parks, wildlife refuges, and hatcheries. It also includes 15 regional water projects. In each instance, a tribe will take over the management of the public lands. The problem is that what tribes do rarely involves any public process, oversight, or transparency. As can be seen in the areas where tribal governments have taken over or been given oversight of public land, public access is often limited or ended, and the tribes won't pay for the management of the sites. Hey, guess who pays for it?
Taxpayers?
Check.
Yeah.
Yeah, so hopefully we've given you a reason to stick with us this morning and learn about this, because honestly, this is flying right under the radar. But your elected representatives will be voting on this and may not know a whole lot about it. So it's your job to carry the torch and get them the information. So Elaine, how's it going today in the beautiful land of Montana?
It is going very great, Aaron, and I love listening to you guys. Banter.
I like listening to us try to awesome try to condense your entire book down into like. She's like, oh,
and thank you, huh?
Well, I'm thinking you're probably wondering, why'd she pick that part?
Well, but, that's a good part to pick because it kind of fits in with the big picture. That book and the information you just read was current in 2005, and it has progressed over the past 10, 11 years. To even the more so. So that was a good good piece to wake up all of American taxpayers.
Well, I don't know that people understand really the kind of, like one of your clips here, you had a small Montana tribe of 5,100 people. In 2004, they had an operating budget of $373 million.
Uh-huh.
Do the math.
And that, mm-hmm. Oh, and there's more where that came from.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Major multi-million-dollar contracts from the Department of Defense. This quiet little tribe, I was really stunned because it's not a nationally visible tribe, the Confederated Salish and Kootenai up here on the Flathead. You don't hear much about them in the paper, hardly anything. And I've been traveling the country and studying Indian tribes and Indian law and policy for 24 years now. And I knew very little about this tribe. I was just stunned at their connections with our federal government and what they're up to. But I'd like to kind of back up and thank you for mentioning my Indian ancestry, because I am called anti-Indian quite frequently, and it's kind of a conflict for me. As you said, my mother and grandmother were enrolled. I am enrollable, but I choose not. I think for the listeners, I had to do a lot of personal sorting before I got into this, because I've had a lifetime affection for American Indians and the history of our country and the noble American Indian warrior and plainsman and all of that. I grew up learning about that and loving it. And so when this issue hit me in the face or at my front porch in Toppenish, Washington back in 1992, I had to really do some personal sorting, and the way I did that was that I make very clear separations from my respect for all culture, certainly Native American culture, but all cultures, and that separates from government decision making. And so my focus and my research and everything I say and do is based on government decision making, and that's what federal Indian policy is. It's secret government decision making. It's best kept secrets between federal bureaucrats and congressmen and a few tribal leaders, and tribal members and the rest of us are out of the loop and uninformed.
But it affects it affects all of us, and not only in the wallet,
yes.
but just our control of our public land and also our power generation and all sorts of different things. There's a lot of aspects of
it. It is now. It has truly exploded in the last 8 years, but it was starting to explode way back in the Nixon administration.
And maybe, Elaine, you could go back to, I know a lot of our listeners are, including myself, totally ignorant about Indian law, but where did this all start? I've read some of the stuff you have here, and right around the Civil War, maybe you could pick it up there, and how we started off, or kind of got off the trail in making these Indian laws and kind of circumventing our Constitution.
Well, you must be reading my mind, Bill, because I put some dates down. I've got a little yellow slip of paper here with some key dates, because one of the things about this beautiful country is it's a very young country. When you're only going back 200 years instead of thousands of years, the history of our country is fairly easy to track, and the Indian policy tracks with it as the country grew and had its problems. I'll start with the year 1855, which was before the Civil War.
Okay.
But it's a critical year for Indian policy, particularly in the Northwest, because most of the Indian treaties were executed by a fellow named Governor Isaac Stevens in 1855. So when I hear, and when I, as my own studies came along, and I'm seeing all that's going on for tribal governments that is not reaching down to its people, all the money, all the programs, all the authority and jurisdiction, but it's not reaching down to its people, who as enrolled members have no civil rights or Bill of Rights. The tribal governments don't recognize the Constitution, even though they have their own Constitution. But anyway, back to 1855, I kind of looked at what was going on in the United States in 1855. And in 1855, that was 5 years before the Civil War, and all hell was breaking loose with the North and South. In 1855, that was before we heard the call, "Go West, young man." We'd already picked up Louisiana purchase lands, and rails were already moving across to the West Coast. And in 1855, these treaties were executed. The Department of War then, which later transitioned to the Department of Interior, but the Department of War was concerned with two folks. They were concerned with the fighting amongst Indian tribes, and they were concerned about the fighting with settlers and vice versa, and they were very interested in settling the West. So they say, "Go West, young man." Young man was given nothing by the federal government except what he could put in his wagon and his own things. And he was given the dream that you can go out west and you find a piece of ground, you improve that piece of ground, we'll give you a homestead patent with a water right attached to it, and you can help settle the west. That's what young man was given, just a dream, and go find a piece of ground. American Indians in 1855 were given their treaties. Now, their treaties come from Old English property law. They're really a sales contract.
And they were not citizens at that time, correct?
No, they were not citizens. There were Indian citizens. That in the Constitution, you see a little thing that says Indians not taxed. Some Indians were citizens as landowners in the New England states and were taxed and were citizens. If they owned property, they were citizens. And some Indians did, and then, even back then. But in any event, the treaties provided Indians... Let me just start with the Bureau of Indian Affairs served two purposes in 1855. It was to protect the Indians and to protect the settlers and to protect both from each other. They were serving two of our populations. So these treaties are set up, and the Indians are ceding land that they are paid for, like a sale. They're ceding land, and they are provided land that is their Indian reservation, and they have the protections of the federal government, and they have the ongoing beneficial use and occupancy of that land, and that's their reservation. They were also given blacksmiths, doctors, schools, commodities, foods, every year since 1855, American Indians have been given a number of abundant resources from the federal government. But in 1855, a young man going west was given nothing. In 1855, we were still buying and selling black Americans as cattle, as property.
Right.
In 1855.
And that was an issue. They had to address that pretty carefully when they were addressing the Indians as well. Because if you give something to one, you have to give it to the other.
There's a direct connection. Because when the Civil War came on and the South secedes and the war goes on and then the war is ended and the United States is trying to bring the Southern states back into the full United States and we have all these Reconstruction laws, one of the Reconstruction laws was the War Powers Act, which allowed those plantation owners in the South that were refusing to free their slaves under the War Powers Act. Marshals could go in on those plantations and take the slaves, which are considered property, not humans, but property, and transport them north where they could be freed under the War Powers Act. Well, that same act, when that process was essentially concluded, there was a Freedmen's Bureau, Federal Freedmen's Bureau that did that, that freed the slaves from belligerent plantation owners. And when that process was pretty much concluded under the War Powers Act, it was the Freedmen's Bureau was transitioned and integrated into the Bureau of Indian Affairs so that the federal government could keep the War Powers Act for all the territories out in the West. And the Indians were at that time were considered federal instrumentalities, and those that are enrolled still are. But that War Powers Act had validity in all the territories until I think you had to have 30,000 people in an area to create a state until the new states in the West were formed up. That was 1855. But my point about that is no American individuals of any ethnicity were given anything from the federal government in 1855 except American Indians. So those treaties were set up to be temporary. Those Stevens treaties all throughout the Northwest were set up to be for about 25 years. Congress and its thinking in those years and those times was really thinking that it would take a couple generations for American Indians to understand and embrace and assimilate the A word, tribal governments hate, and to become full citizens of the United States. So that was the plan. Temporary treaties for 25 years. And if you move forward from a little over 25 years, by 1871, Congress ended all the treaty making because the assimilation movement was the goal.
And how many tribes had they made treaties with by then?
So there were 65. Well, there are several hundred treaties. There are multiple treaties with individuals.
Oh, that's right. How many? But it was under 100 tribes at that time.
Yes, and that gets very important in our contemporary times.
Absolutely. Okay, we have to take a really quick break. I just wanted to tie up that tiny loose end. When we come back, we're going to dig.
We'll pick up the story.
We're going to dig farther into this.
It gets better.
Because honestly, I think a lot of people now are kind of curious, how does this work? They get to have their own sovereign government, but where do we fit? And we're going to explain that today. Well, I'm using the term we loosely. It's Elaine. She's going to explain that. So you're listening to We the People Radio. We're here with Elaine Willman, author of Going to Pieces, The Dismantling of the United States of America. Stick with us. You've got a lot of information on the site, wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them when they move into your neighborhood? They take over, but good. They want you all body and soul. Body.
You're listening to We the People on Community Talk Radio for the North State, AM 1460, KCNR.
Do you want to have more fun in 2016?
The Reading Civic Auditorium has you covered.
Tim Flannery and the Lunatic Fringe are back February 13th.
C.S. Lewis's Screwtape Letters is now a critically acclaimed theatrical masterpiece. The Associated Press calls devilishly funny. Don't miss it, March 4th.
March 6th, Shinedown rocks the house for one epic night.
March 20th, join Celtic sensation Lorena McKennitt for an intimate evening of music.
And who can resist the hardest working man in show business? That's right, Jay Leno is in the house March 26th.
Now don't get scammed on your tickets to these great shows. Go to www.ridingcivic.com or contact our box office at 530-229-0022. For more show announcements and pre-sale access, sign up for our emails at the Reading Civic Auditorium's website, www.readingcivic.com, or contact the box office at 530-229-0022.
Uncle Bob, where did Mount Shasta Springwater come from?
Well, you see, we get wrung out of the clouds as we pass over the top of Mount Shasta. Then we become part of huge glaciers. Then we flow through miles of volcanic rocks. Then we pop out of a spring at the base of Mount Shasta.
Uncle Bob, where did I come from?
You'll have to ask your parents about that one.
Pure and simple, naturally the best. Mount Shasta Springwater.
For free delivery and setup, call 1-800-922-6227.
Or go to MountShastaSpringwater.com.
So, Brenda, guess what?
Oh, what now?
Boomer Tech Radio is changing a little bit again.
Oh, my gosh. Just like keeping up with technology. Can't keep up with Boomer Tech Radio.
Right now, every Saturday from noon until 2 o'clock, you can listen to Boomer Tech Radio for 2 hours back-to-back right here on KCNR 1460. And we are brought to you every week by
Advanced Automotive.
Safe, reliable car care for their customers and our community. So listen every Saturday for Boomer Tech Radio, noon to 2, right here on KCNR 1460.
It'll help you keep up with technology.
KCNR, 1460 AM. If we're not talking about it, it's probably not important. KCNR, 1460 AM.
Took away our ways of life, the tomahawk and the bowie knife. Took away our native tongue and taught their English to our young.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about the Cherokee Nation.
That's Elaine's mom and her grandmother.
I really love that song. I have always loved that song.
I've always liked that song, too. We seem to be playing it a lot lately.
We have a rich American history. The kids don't get in, well, they haven't for decades, get in school anymore. And the American Indian played a very strong part in that. And some of it was, has been very, very painful. But, I just really love that song. You know, so let me pick up where I left off. I was at 1871 when Congress ended treaty making, and then they moved forward. Their goal was to bring Indians into full citizenship and give them the opportunity to own land and be full citizens with all other Americans. And so they were heading towards that Allotment Act, the Dawes Act of 1887. That was about a little longer than 25 years after the treaties. They brought in the Dawes Act, and the Dawes Act opened up those reservations to individual Indians that were allowed the opportunity to have their own personal piece of ground with a water patent attached to it, guaranteed water and a piece of ground. And as that tribal member received his allotment, he walked away from his tribal government, and he became a citizen of that state with his allotment. Was no longer under the tribal government, he was a citizen of the state with the Dawes Act and all those allotments that opened up the Indians. And they followed that with the Homestead Act to encourage settlers to go onto the Indian reservations and homestead some land. And this was all the process of, building the first schools, the first churches, the first little communities and towns. And it was part of settling the West. One thing to note is that the homesteaders that were in many cases, and it certainly applies here, according to the history of the elders of this tribe, the homesteaders were very, very helpful. There was a lot of friction between whites or settlers and Indians, but there was also pretty good relationships, too. As an example, what was going on here on the Flathead Reservation was there were many, many tribes in the area, and they were all fighting with each other over bison, and the Salish Kootenai men were getting killed in great numbers, and they were not able to access the bison, and they were a bison subsistence tribe. And so as the homesteaders came out, and this is according to their own elder history, as the homesteaders came out, they armed the Indians and fought with the Indians to fight off the Salish Kootenai, to fight off these very aggressive tribes that were taking all the bison. And then they helped the Indians learn farming, and so there were good relationships between the homesteaders and Indians on reservations in many cases. You never hear about that now, but there were. So moving forward to, I want to just tag the year 1921, and I'll come back to it. But in 1921, Secretary of Interior Albert Fall, along with the West getting settled, Albert Fall, the Secretary of Interior, famously known for the Teapot Dome scandal, for which he was impeached and went to prison, but this Secretary of Interior, Fall, required that all the new water and energy systems being installed in the West be located on or near Indian reservations. Now, that's a key piece that occurred 100 years ago that has big play now in 2016, so I'll come back to it. But again, moving forward in 1924, with the reservations opened and the Homestead Act and the Indians are being assimilated, we're all going to be one people. The Snyder Act, all American Indians were made full citizens. Snyder Act. It should have all been over. All of this federal Indian policy should have ended on or about 1924, when every American Indian then and now is a full American citizen. Then we had this catastrophe, I call it a catastrophe, happened 10 years later in 1934. An avowed communist by the name of John Collier, who had been living and studying the Pueblo Indians in the Southwest, and had published books on communism, he thought the communal living of the Pueblo tribe was the way to go for Indians. And he thought the Indians were losing all their land, and he proposed the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934. That was an about-face, a complete turn away from everything that had been put into place from 1855 to 1934. He said, these Indians need to live separately. They need to have their culture, and we need to help them do that, and they need to have their own government. And so there's the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934.
So they were citizens, and then it's like, no, now you're not citizens. Now you have to be separate.
Yes, they became dual. And this is the schizophrenia of federal Indian policy, and frankly. They became dual citizens. They were full citizens of the United States off of their reservation, but those who were enrolled in a tribal government were not full, lose that full citizenship. They lose the Bill of Rights. They have no 14th Amendment. There is an Indian Civil Rights Act that's, I call it toilet paper, because there's no enforcement authority, and the tribal members have a very different governing system than what you and I and folks across the country do. They have no protections from their own tribal government. They have no recourse. They can't go into a state or federal court and say, my government has harmed me. And if they bravely disagree with the tribal government decision, there is retaliation. And I've been working with people that have been, tribal members here, that have been severely punished for speaking up against some of the stuff going on here. But anyway, this 1934 was a key turning point that started growing tribalism across the country. And that just escalated even further under the Nixon policy. Now, going back to this War Powers Act, the War Powers Act that was put in place in 1871 was for territories. As the states became states and the federal territories went away, the War Powers Act could not be used against the state. but that was used to settle and organize the states, and that was used to carve out Indian reservations. And Nixon was one who wanted to really grow federal government. And Nixon saw that that war powers was still available to it. And the Nixon policies under his watch from 1969 through 74 greatly ramped up the authority of the federal government over states, created the Environmental Protection Agency and some other little beastly organizations. And Nixon was had a strong belief that the tribal members were better off living apart from the rest of the world in their own government, and he really, really escalated the growth of tribalism in this country. Clinton, when Clinton came on by 93, he did the same thing. Prior to Clinton, the funding for Indian tribes came almost solely from the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Clinton created an executive order that required every federal agency to set up an Indian office within its agency and to set up consulting protocols and to include tribal governments in their budgeting of these 29 federal agencies. So now the funding going out to these tribes is not just from one, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, it's from all 29. So here's where the taxpayer really needs to pay attention if we just do the math. 29 federal agencies are now annually funding 566 tribal governments. 29 agencies funding 566 tribal governments every year since the Clinton administration. And actually since further back in 1934, and actually all the way back to 1855, but we now have 566 tribes where at the time of their citizenship there were about 65. It has just exploded under the Nixon administration and Clinton administration, and the Bush administrations were no better. The federal Indian policy has quite a lucrative money wheel that I don't know if I want to talk about that, but you're probably coming up on a break again.
We are. We need to take a really quick break. Give us a dollar figure. What kind of money goes out annually from these 29 agencies?
Isn't that interesting? Because nobody's ever looked.
That's a great reason.
Nobody, and they won't look. They will not look. They have been requested and required to look. And they say, oh, well, we just can't count it all up. You know, but it's huge. I'm guessing it's equivalent to our military defense budget. Just doing the math. And just look at the tribe here has $373 million annual operating budget. The tribe where I lived in Wisconsin had a $574 million annual operating budget when there was only about 3,000 tribal members in the area. The money is huge.
But the poverty needle hasn't
changed at all. And that's part of the problem. There's no oversight, no accountability. These tribal governments are run by ruling families for the large part. There are decent ones. I'm certainly not saying they're all rotten, but the money does not get down and out to upgrade the quality of life of their people. And to me, that's just obscene. When you look at the amount of money these tribes are raking in every year, but they just have waiting lists for housing, and it's just pitiful. It's unfair, and they can't speak out against it.
Yeah, it's not working. At the end of the day, it's not working out for anybody.
Not for anybody. Not for anybody. It's kind of a dinosaur that should have gone away in 1924, and now it's just this ongoing conflict in one state after another, with all this stuff that has been piled on to the benefit of not just tribal leaders. I'm going to say it greatly benefits Congress. There's a whole Indian industry, all the law firms, all the lobbyists. You know, all the slot machine manufacturers.
I was going to say, the casino industry has done all right.
Oh, yes. Yeah, and that's the money wheel I want to talk about.
All right. We're going to come back and chat more about that. We have Elaine as our hostage for the full 2 hours today. So just in case you thought we were going to wrap this up in 20 minutes, we're not. We have another hour. You're listening to We the People Radio with Aaron, Bill, and Bob. We're speaking with Elaine Moman, author of Going to Pieces, The Dismantling of the United States of America. We'll be right back.
Listening to We the People on Community Talk Radio for the North State, AM 1460 KCNR.
If you are running your own business, you already know that if there are 1,000 items on your to-do list, you really have 3,000 things to get done. Success in business is in the details. You need help. Let the smart professionals at Five Star Bank help you take care of those financial details. Yes, smart people doing good business. Life is 10% of what happens to us and 90% of how we react to it. Be positive. Those at the top of the mountain did not fall there. Visit us at Five Star Bank and let us show you how we specialize in emerging business and commercial real estate. Five Star Bank also specializes in hard work, working hard for those that believe that success is just on the other side of the next opportunity. Thomas Jefferson was a great believer in opportunity, for he found that the harder he worked, the more he had of it. Your time is as valuable as your success. So visit us at Five Star Bank, 358 Hartnell in Reading, or call Eric Woodstrom at 223-6652. Online at fivestarbank.com. Five Star Bank. Professional, progressive, and personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
People think it's so easy being a fish. They think we just swim around all day enjoying the scenery.
Yeah, they certainly don't know how hard it is to survive all the nasty stuff they toss down their storm drains.
You're telling me. Yesterday I had to swim my fin off just to try and dodge some motor oil.
I hear ya. This morning it was fertilizer. Nothing quite as fun as starting off the day trying to outswim the green monster.
What the fish are trying to say is not everyone understands that stormwater does not get treated. When it rains, the pollutants on our streets flow directly into our streams and rivers and can have adverse effects on plants, animals, drinking water, and yes, even fish. To learn more, call Reading Municipal Utilities at 224-6068. 224-6068.
Incoming! Not the car washing signs!
When it rains, it drains. Learn how you can protect our waterways and streams. Call 224-6068. 224-6068.
See you at the lake.
KCNR, 1460 AM. The most local programming in Northern California.
Do you remember your President Nixon?
I do remember President Nixon, but I don't think any of us knew he had anything to do with Indian policy. Every week we learn some stuff we either didn't know or forgot.
Hey, Elaine, I imagine you're probably going to get to this, but I just want to make sure that we don't forget about the 13th and 14th Amendments and how they all kind of played into this whole story.
They had a big play in that they did not apply to Indians. They excluded, the 14th Amendment excluded Indians. And that's part of the problem today.
Right.
And that's part of the struggle that tribal members have with their own tribal governments today. Our national organization has been pounding on Congress over for a number of years and talking about the 14th Amendment as necessary to be provided for tribal members for many, many years. So far, it's not getting anywhere, and it is it is a protection that all other American citizens have, but Indians don't. So it's a very sad piece of the decision making that the government has done on this. I want to move up to 1988 as quickly as possible and talk about this money wheel, but I will say that during the Nixon administration and thereafter, a good deal of major legislation, the Indian Self-Determination Act, came on, and that allowed tribes greater freedom to more autonomously self-govern. It also bloated up the federal funding that started going out to the tribes. Then they gave them the Indian Civil Rights Act, so that was in right before Nixon. That that gave them, that was, you remember the civil rights battle that our whole country went through, Brown versus Board of Education and whatnot. Well, Congress thought Indians needed civil rights too. And they put in the Indian Civil Rights Act, but they forgot to put any enforcement mechanism or any recourse that a tribal member could have or pursue if his civil rights are violated. So it's a nice fairy tale piece of legislation on the books that looks good, and it is of no use to the tribal members that have problems with their tribal government. Where this thing went totally off the rails, one big push that started was a 10-year period. I need to say, in 1988, Congress gave American Indians the gambling monopoly with the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. And you know what was funny for me? When I hear about that, I'm thinking, oh, wow, we used to have to do destination gambling. We'd go out to Atlantic City or Vegas or Tahoe, and our country would do destination gambling. And I thought, boy, the American gaming industry is going to fight this. Wrong-o. The American gaming industry jumped in full force. I call it McDonald's for the mob, because it put casinos across the country on Indian reservations. These non-tribal gaming industries at every level, investors and whatnot, would go find a tribe. They'd even go help a tribe get federally recognized and say, "We'll help you with your federal recognition. We'll pay for the process. We'll buy the land. We'll build the casino. We'll train your employees, and we'll just take a 7-year management contract from you, and you can get your casino open." So the American gaming industry has greatly profited from the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, because the tribal folks they had the gaming monopoly, but they did not have the expertise or skills to build and train and operate their own casinos. So rather than fight the monopoly, it is a federal monopoly, the rest of the gaming industry jumped right in, and that's why you have over 130 casino tribes in California, in casinos, off reservations and on all your best exits. But that set up the money wheel, and this is the money wheel I want to talk about, because our country went through a 10-year period between 2000 and 2010. Things were rolling along, and the political clout and financial clout of American Indians was on the move, but it really came into play in the year 2000. We have a Federal Election Commission, an FEC, and this election commission is three appointed persons. They are not elected, and they put out advisory opinions. They're just advisory opinions. But in May of 2005, the Federal Election Commission put out an advisory opinion, and this is right before the Bush-Gore presidential election. In May of 2005, the advisory commission puts out an opinion that tribal governments are not governments for purposes of contributing funds to candidates or political parties. They're tribal governments for purposes of what they need to be as tribal governments, but for purposes of America's elections, they are not governments, they're persons. And that was in May of 2005. Now, there's not a single, your city government, my county, your state, there's no government in the United States that can cut a check to a candidate or a political party. But tribal governments do it in big numbers to both political parties because of that little advisory opinion that became law of the land. The next thing that happened was the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform, where, by golly, they're going to rein in all this big spending in elections. They did this. And so McCain and Feingold put this reform, campaign finance reform. I made three separate trips to D.C. on my own dime, begging both of those senators to please include two words, Indian tribes, because if the terms are not expressly in print in a statute, they're exempt. So McCain-Feingold went through without those two words, and McCain later said, oh, it was an unintentional inadvertent consequence. From 2000 until 2002, now these tribes are all moneyed up big time with gaming, and mind you, the gaming money is pretty much free. They are federally subsidized for housing, education, health, law enforcement, tribal courts. All their basics are federally subsidized by you and me, so the gaming profits are pretty much free money. And they're used to buy what I call the four L's. That gaming money buys land, it buys litigators, legal counsel, it buys lobbyists, and it buys legislators at every level of government. The four L's. That's what the casino gaming money is primarily used for. So between 2000 and 2010, when the Supreme Court overturned McCain-Feingold and opened up the funding for other organizations and entities, I certainly didn't approve of the Citizens United ruling that just bloated too much money into elections, but I was relieved that the Indian gaming dollars were not the only big money in town for 10 years. And during that 10-year period, the halls of Congress were just packed with lobbyists. Now, governor's offices, state legislators, every local level, tribal governments were literally purchasing our elected officials. And this is a population that's about 4% of our country, but there's only about 1% that's actually enrolled in a tribal government. So this is huge political influence on the system, and that set the stage for even more perks and more things coming online up to this year of 2016.
And you know, the other thing I learned from you yesterday was that a lot of the residents on the reservations, I don't know if it's all reservations or just, I'm not sure the numbers, I know you are, but a lot of those people are not tribal members.
Yes. And that's the funny part, because the folks that live in
pretty common,
the urban area.
Uh-huh.
Pardon?
Yeah, and I guess that's pretty common.
It's absolutely common because they were opened up. They were opened up to everybody, And so, and the other thing that your average listener, and certainly the people in D.C. are oblivious to all this, these Indian reservations do not set in a vacuum. Every single Indian reservation is co-located within a state, within counties, within towns. And so there's dual jurisdictions and dual conflicts over jurisdictions. And almost every reservation except two that I'm aware of are predominantly non-Indian. Where I lived in Hobart is 80% non-Indian or more.
How can that be? Explain that a little bit. What do you mean non-Indian?
Hold on. We're having a train wreck here. Better take a quick break, and we'll be right back. Because we have like a lot of questions. We don't want to take a break. We don't have time for breaks.
Okay.
We're going to do it anyway, though. Bob said we have to. Bob's mean. We'll be back. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Outlaw, half Cherokee and Choctaw. My baby, she's a Chippewa. Oh, she's a one of a kind. All my friends call me Bear Claw. The village chicken is my pawpaw. He gets his orders from my mama. She makes him walk the line.
You're listening to We the People on AM 1460 KCNR.
Whether it's a 7-year-old battling cancer, a dad injured in a car accident, or me, a mom of two saved by blood transfusions. Every 3 seconds, someone is in need of blood. You don't have to be a doctor, a firefighter, or a police officer to save lives like mine. donating blood makes you a hero. Contact Blood Centers of the Pacific at our own Reading Shasta Blood Center, 221-0600.
Tobacco and Brew, located at 2143 Hilltop Drive, offers the best in coffee and other drinks at Espresso Joe's. Lattes, cappuccinos, espressos, tea, and much more are offered at great prices and even better taste. Walk next door to the finest tobacco emporium in Northern California. That includes all types of tobacco and accessories, and a walk-in humidor that is awesome with variety and taste. Tobacco and Brew, a better-known business that supports our community. 2143 Hilltop Drive, open 7 days a week. Tobacco and Brew.
Attention, Whose Line Is It Anyway fans. Get ready for an evening of hilarious comedy with Colin Mochrie and Brad Sherwood February 5th at the Cascade Theater. You've watched them on TV for years. Now witness the incredible comedy of Whose Line Is It Anyway's funniest duo, live. Tickets are on sale now at the Cascade box office by calling 243-8877 or online at cascadetheater.org.
There's no point during this show do Brad and I know what's going on.
I think we're ready to get this show started.
Yes. All right.
National News with a Local View, KCNR, 1460 AM.
Now you can swear and kick in Vegas that you're not a gambling man. Then you will find your back in Vegas with a handle in your hand.
little gambling song there for us. Bob's going to leave no stone unturned today. So let's see, for people who kind of coming in late and might get distracted by the news break coming up here, we are speaking with Elaine Willman, the author of Going to Pieces, The Dismantling of the United States of America. And dismantling, explain the title, Elaine. And then we'll go back to the story after the break.
You know, my editors picked that title because I couldn't figure out. The book is about a road trip. Some of your listeners may remember the old Thelma and Louise movie, but these two wacky broads that took a road trip. And the book is about myself and a videographer traveling from Washington State to New York across 17 Indian reservations. We held the camera up and interviewed. We just wanted to listen, and we listened to tribal members, to teachers, bankers, sheriffs, farmers, ranchers, folks that live on these reservations. And it was a life-changing trip for me because what we were hearing across the country was really alarming. And I'd promised every single one of them that we would get their stories told, but we couldn't fit it all into a little documentary. So I transcribed 130 hours of film, and nobody even asked me to change their names. And that's the book, Going to Pieces. It's that trip, and you sort of hear these interesting personal experiences while learning about Indian policy. So dismantling is, there is, and it's on steroids right now in 2016, there is this dramatic effort to expand tribalism as an authority that replaces state authority and replaces the governing jurisdiction of counties and towns and removes the state protections of the citizens that live on the reservation. As I said, most folks that live on reservations are non-Indians. They're citizens of their state. But the feds are helping these tribal governments now. They're extending their own federal authority out to tribes to govern non-members. That's never been allowed. It's certainly not in their own tribal constitutions, which limit them to their property and their people. But they're rolling out tribalism to supplant state authority in a very big way. And it's a collusion of several of the agencies coming out of the Secretary of Interior's office, the BLM, the National Park Service, the Fish and Wildlife, the Army Corps of Engineers, the Bureau of Indian Affairs. It's quite a collusion that is using tribal governments and Indian reservations as launch pads to dismantle the state protections for property owners and citizens. And there's now directly attacking and capturing state waters, state energy, and going after the crop production. The feds are. That's where this is.
Yeah,
going
we haven't even gotten into the crop production part. There's a lot more to this. We could do a week of radio. So
we have
another hour with Elaine here, and I hope you'll stick with us. Ton of information on the website and how you can get this information and do your own research. WeThePeopleRadio.us.
KCNR, Shasta Redding.
News this hour from townhall.com. I'm Gordon Griffin. At least 25 people have died as a result of the mammoth snowstorm that pounded the eastern U.S. The latest fatalities reported include a Pennsylvania man who died after a passing snowplow trapped him inside his running car, and a New Jersey mother and child who died while sitting in a car that had its tailpipe covered in snow. Several people have died while shoveling snow. Authorities say they hope to reopen a section of the Pennsylvania Turnpike soon near Pittsburgh. More than 500 cars, trucks, and buses got stuck there Friday night as a snowstorm hit. Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney says that the snow cleanup is far from over in the city.
The snow emergency remains in effect until it is declared over. Now, this is all about keeping the cars off of our main routes and getting our plows access to the curbsides.
Meanwhile, Congress is revising its schedule because of the snowstorm that socked in the nation's capital. The House is putting off votes until next week, including one on overriding President Obama's health care veto. And senators don't plan to return to work until Wednesday evening. A new survey says Americans have considerable doubts about the government's ability to solve major problems in this presidential election year.
The results come from an Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs research poll conducted in December. It found that 6 in 10 people questioned expressed only slight confidence, or none at all, that the federal government can make progress on the problems facing the country in 2016. Terrorism and health care are the issues that adults cited as priorities, though various economic matters combined to take the top billing overall. The polling suggests that the electorate is more focused on the economy and domestic affairs than on foreign policy. Bob Agnew reporting.
Former Israeli President Shimon Peres has been taken to a hospital after experiencing chest pains. A spokeswoman says medics treated Peres at his home and detected a light irregular heart rate. More on these stories at townhall.com.
Are you ready to take your education to the next level? Arizona State University now offers over 90 top-tier degree programs, 100% online. With ASU's highly ranked online programs, you'll earn the same degree as our on-campus students, with the ability to learn wherever you want, whenever you want. Same world-renowned faculty, same leading education, same global recognition from one of the top universities in the world. Call 1-800-581-5369. That's 1-800-581-5369.
I'm Jamie from Sherman Oaks, and I just graduated with my degree from Arizona State University. I chose ASU because I received the quality education I deserve in the major I wanted, all from my home.
Jamie's not the only one to earn a degree from ASU. There are over 90 degree programs offered 100% online from one of the top universities. Now's the time to learn more about earning your degree online from Arizona State University. Call 1-800-581-5369. That's 1-800-581-5369.
A week before the Iowa caucuses, and the Des Moines Register knows who they like.
An editorial Saturday, the paper endorsed Marco Rubio and Hillary Clinton for president. The most prominent daily newspaper in the state said Rubio was, quote, whip smart and could chart a new direction for Republicans, while praising Clinton, saying she's an outstanding candidate deserving of Democrats' support. The paper did acknowledge Clinton was not perfect, citing her email problems and her changing positions on homosexual marriage and immigration, but said she was more qualified than Bernie Sanders or Martin O'Malley. The paper said Rubio has questions about his experience, but offers a better, uplifting message than his challengers. Rhonda Rockster reporting.
Officials say that the three inmates who escaped from a Southern California maximum security jail should be considered armed and dangerous. The Orange County Sheriff says an investigation has been launched into how the inmates managed to obtain the tools to cut through half-inch steel bars at the jail in Santa Ana. News and analysis at townhall.com. I'm Gordon Griffin. El Nino storms have drenched California, but Golden State reservoirs remain at historic lows.
In California's agricultural Central Valley, the federally operated reservoirs are now 49% full, but that's only 2% higher than on October 1st. The U.S. Bureau of Reclamation says that much of the recent heavy rainfall has soaked into the landscape, which was left parched by 4 years of drought. The Sierra Nevada snowpack has grown, but hasn't started to melt into those critically low reservoirs. One state water district manager is blaming environmental regulations that protect endangered fish for allowing the water to flow out to the sea, a claim which the feds dispute. George Bonzani reporting.
A survey finds the average price of gasoline has plunged 14 cents over the past 2 weeks to $1.91 a gallon.
Industry analyst Trilby Lundberg says that's 16 cents a gallon less than a year ago, and the lowest price in 7 years. She says the price drop may soon end as crude costs start going up again. More on these stories at townhall.com.
The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Welcome back. That's a short break. We didn't even get out of our chairs. You are listening to We the People Radio. I hope you will join us online because, you know what, a lot of people are joining us online. Let's see, brief commercial break on that
Many
one.
Many of them in Montana.
But honestly, I did a little homework. I know you find that shocking. We are now over 48,000 hits on the website since December of, 2014? So in almost 14 months, we've been doing all right. People are actually, people are actually tuning in and really listening and stuff. So we would, I kind of forgot to put out my pitch at the beginning, but I really do hope you'll go to the website and contact us, send us guests, ideas for programs, and especially if you'd like somebody to sponsor the program, they'll get good visibility here. We also air on the East Coast Mondays from 1 to 3 Eastern Time on the Conservative Commandos Radio Network. So get a lot of good exposure, and we get to educate folks on both sides of the aisle and both sides of the country. So let's see. All right, Elaine, back to you.
And to your credit, Aaron and Bill, you handle very heavy, controversial issues with a light heart, and I think that's invaluable. I think that's
kind of our saving grace.
You're fun to listen to, even if it's a tough subject, and I appreciate that.
Well, we found that if we don't handle it that way, you just end up being haters, you know. And
well,
nobody
just
wants that. You can't really have a conversation when it goes down that road.
True, it's hard to learn stuff. So Bob throws in a bunch of fun music, I know some people think like, "What do these guys just screw around all the time?" Not exactly. I mean, this is a tough topic. Because
it can come off
like you don't like, that you're anti-Native American. And that's how I'm sure you get pegged
a
lot.
At all.
Correct.
It does seem like that. And every time you disagree with a tribal government decision, if you dare to disagree or even speak up, you're a racist. And there used to be 5 or 6 national organizations studying this issue. And they were all demeaned and smeared so badly they've disappeared, except for our Citizens Equal Rights Alliance. We were equally smeared, and we continue to be called a hate group, an anti-Indian, and all this and that. But there's information that has to be made known. And so you can call me or our organization any name you want. We're staying on track with getting this information out. And our original purpose was to assist tribal members. They do not have the same protections you and I have. And they live a very different life. But most of them that are still on the reservations know nothing different. And so it's a sad, sad thing. But I would like to consider the first hour like background or history or yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And spend this time talking about today.
Okay.
Because I really want to talk about what's happening in Montana. And but I want to lay a little background along with that, too. In the western states, we have major river systems. You have the big Missouri River system, the Columbia River system, and these very big river systems. And the federal government, with the help of the Army Corps of Engineers and all those little alphabet agencies under the Secretary of Interior, have carved these arbitrary boundaries and made these major river watershed management, federal watershed management plans that take in, let's start with the Missouri River. Yeah, the Missouri River flows through 9 states. It takes every little creek and stream and tributary that feeds into the Missouri, and that becomes the management, the federal watershed management plan. That is put together, and for decades, that has been to promote and encourage crop production and farming and agriculture, to promote local businesses, to promote tourism, to protect the natural resources. those have been shifted in the recent years. Those big federal watershed management plans have now been shifted to promote tribal sovereignty and then protect the sacred and cultural resources of Native Americans, and then to protect the endangered species and the fish and wildlife issues. And way down at the bottom of the food chain on these federal watershed management plans is maybe there'll be a little irrigation left over for the crops. Now, those management plans are implemented by a team. And so there's 9 states in the Missouri watershed, and there's a lot of tribes. Each team, each state may have 1 representative on the implementation team. So there's 9 state representatives. There are 29 tribes in that area. They each get a representative. So on the implementation, you're in a group with 29 tribal voices and 9 state voices. And that's shifting everything in these major watershed management plans. That's going on today. The Columbia River is my favorite. That's 4 states. 4 states. Washington State, Oregon, Idaho, a little piece of Montana. So there's 4 states representatives at the implementation team for the Columbia Basin Rivershed Water Management. That area, those 4 states have 53 tribes. Guess who's controlling the whole Columbia River Basin and all that Salmon Recovery Act stuff and all your, and it even feeds down into and eventually impacts the Klamath area.
Right.
So these are federal programs that have shifted from public interest to tribal sovereignty. That's part of the game going on now. Here in Montana, it just shocks me to speak of this because I've just been stunned by what I've learned. I moved out here 6 months ago, and I thought I was coming out to help folks on the water, but it's a lot more than that. But there is a Salish Kootenai Water Compact, Settlement Agreement, Water Compact, that was approved April 11th, we're going to say illegally approved April 11th by the state legislature by a rule changing in the Capitol that approved it by minority vote instead of 2/3 required by their constitution. But the Salish Kootenai Water Compact is an agreement between the state of Montana, the Salish Kootenai tribe, and the federal government. And the end result of this compact is that 11 counties, all the little counties that border the Idaho Panhandle, 11 counties and 350,000 Montana citizens are directly or indirectly affected by this compact. That compact has to be ratified by Congress. And, of course, the folks here and the folks that I'm working with are going to be doing everything we can to see that it isn't ratified by Congress. But even if that compact didn't exist, what has happened is that the state of Montana has walked away in the compact, and for all practical purposes, even without it, they have walked away from their control or authority over all the waters in these 11 counties. And we have the big Flathead Lake here. We have a system that comes down out of Canada. We have abundant water that comes out. It comes down through some major dams, the Hungry Horse and the Kerr Dam. And all of this water has been put under the control of the Salish Kootenai tribe, with the state of Montana absolutely walking away. This reservation has an irrigation project. You remember the homesteaders, and this is predominantly non-Indian. We're a big growing area. My neighbor does 2 million in potatoes every year. We have cattlemen and whatnot. They rely on runoff from the mountains that feeds into the irrigation system, and they rely on the irrigation system. Currently, that big irrigation infrastructure is under the operation and management of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, though. What we have today in Montana is that the federal government or tribal government, federal government meaning the BIA or the United States, the federal government controls 100% access to all water. And then on the reservation, we have the Mission Valley Power Company that provides everyone's electricity. The Mission Valley Power Company is owned by the Bureau of Indian Affairs and managed by the tribal government. So the federal government controls 100% access and availability to all water, and they control 100% access to all electricity on this reservation. do you need water and electricity for any livelihood on your land?
Well, the federal government controls the water on most of the country, don't they? I mean, on and off reservations.
Yeah, but there's control managed by elected officials and where you have public input, and then there's control where it's all done by somebody you can't get to. That's a good point,
Aaron, because ordinarily all of this water is under, and rate setting for power, rate setting for water, is under the review of your state public services commission. The state has walked away from that too. The water and power coming off of the dams, the wholesale rates, do not have to be reviewed by the Montana State Public Services Commission, and there's no ceiling. The retail rates coming out from Mission Valley Power are not subject to review, and there's no ceiling by the Public Services Commission. So what's happening here is a financial and energy economic squeeze on all of the agricultural industry here that is the linchpin. It is the economy. It is the absolute economy of about six towns. The landowners are being squeezed up. I'll give you a little example. One of my neighbors had 200 acres in peas. The week we moved here in July, there was a big heat wave, and the neighbor had 200 acres in peas that were just coming to peak, and he lost his irrigation water. It scorched 80% of his crop. About the time he salvaged 20% of his crop, they turned his water back on. We've had cattlemen here who lose their stock water, and they have to relocate hundreds of cattle to some other piece of ground that has water. And about the time the cattle get relocated, they'll turn the guy's stock water back on. Nasty games being played here. Against the very folks that helped them survive years ago. So it's sad times, but the biggest culprit is the state of Montana itself. Your governor here and your attorney general here and your legislators here have all absolutely abandoned 350,000 citizens in the western side of Montana. And they added $55 million of state taxpayer dollars into the compact to help the tribe do this to us. It's just a beast. But it is a model that will roll out across other
tribes. Well, see, we're already seeing that. And it's interesting. For the folks that live in the East, we make this comment all the time. They just don't have the federal land problems that we do out here in the West.
No.
But we see it here. They made an administrative law decision up in the Klamath that the tribe up there has time immemorial water right. Well, what the heck? So
isn't that cute?
Yeah. So your property just became worthless because without a water, obviously they're.
Yeah.
So anyway, well, before I go on a rant and we have to take and we have to take a break here because it's like a pull the ripcord. David has called from Montana. He has a question for you, so want to make sure and don't hold him over forever. David, fire away.
Oh, excellent. Let me just turn this down real quick. The question is, I was curious if Elaine Willman is familiar with the book New Tactics of Global War, written by Jeff Nyquist, who spells out that Henry Kissinger, who happened to be our Secretary of State back in the Nixon days, and she mentioned Nixon, and
this
speaks to Henry Kissinger as being, per a British double agent by the name of Michael Golanowski, whereas he was on a list to be part of a accepted GRU, which was a group, a spy network known as Red Orchestra, the Road to Capella. He was on the list as being one of those folks brought into the Communist Party. And so this spells out, through Jeff Nyquist's book, which really starts to connect some interesting dots through the Nixon era, where Indian policy, especially in the state of Montana, with the Montana new constitution, has essentially adopted, I believe what Elaine can really speak well to, a direction that has led us down this path here locally, anyhow, in Montana, and then let's just say on a macro level across the nation with regard to Turkey as a nation and maybe other nations to lease lands within certain or maybe all federally recognized reservations. And these lands are leased for 75 years. And it's just, it speaks to, essentially, the enemy in the shadows, which is driven by Russia intelligence. And anyhow, that was my question.
David, give me the author again, please.
Oh, sure. Jeff Nyquist, Nyquist, The New Tactics of Global War. Sun Tzu is... Anyway, that was my question.
That's awesome. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
David, I'm not
okay, Elaine, you have 2 minutes to think about your answer. We're going to squeeze in a quick break and come right back.
Okay.
Glad we're hearing from our folks up there in Montana.
Yeah.
That's probably snowing and stuff. It's a good day to listen to the radio. Alrighty, we'll be back with you. We're adding all this information. It's all on the website for you, wethepeopleradio.us. We hope you go there, send it to your friends, post it on Facebook, that kind of stuff, and share the info because this is the only place you'll get this much of it on one topic.
Well, you filled up my head with so many lies. You twisted my
Stay tuned for more We the People on Community Talk Radio for the North State, AM 1460 KCNR.
Hi, I'm Rich Novelli, president of Wellgate Sports Club.
And I'm Allie Evers, proud owner of Boheme Spa.
At Wellgate, we're dedicated to building a club focused on improving the quality of your life, which is why we are so excited to introduce our new partner, Boheme Spa.
Thank you, Rich. Both Boheme Spa and Wellgate Sports Club share the same business philosophy and commitment to mind, body, and health. Conveniently located inside the Wellgate Sports Club, Boheme Spa is Reading's premier Aveda Concept Spa, featuring the complete line of Aveda products and Aveda signature services.
Wellgate Sports Club, in partnership with Boheme Spa, is proud to announce a groundbreaking new membership category called Rejuvenate. In addition to a standard premium access membership, Rejuvenate members receive 2 spa treatments per month from Boheme Spa for the term of the membership.
Reward yourself for your hard work and effort at the club with relaxing and restorative treatments.
Call 768-1205 today. Wellgate Sports Club, where you'll experience exceptional every day.
When you're looking to add a pet to your family, Haven Humane Society is a place to start. Hi, this is Mark from Haven to tell you that shelter pets make the best pets. With kittens, puppies, dogs, cats, bunnies, guinea pigs, hamsters, snakes, birds, and more, Haven has a pet that is the right fit for your family. We also provide education, training, spaying and neutering, dog licensing, and so much more. If you're looking for a way to help, our amazing volunteers have fun with the animals while helping us to save lives. For more information, call 241-1653 or visit havenhumane.org. Like us on Facebook and follow our progress as we work towards a day with no more homeless pets in the North State.
Hi, it's Linda Bott
and Molly Kidd. Join us on Thursday night during On the Spot at 6 p.m.
Also on the first Thursday of every month, join Rhonda Ball and James Masada from Enjoy the Magazine. We bring you art, entertainment, food, highlights, and all the stuff going on in the North State.
Don't forget the giveaways, lots of laughs, and great information.
That's On the Spot Thursdays at 6 p.m.
here on KCNR 1460.
Brought to you by Dandelion Gift and Apparel, Wind River Resort at Casino, and Crackmaster Windshield and Repair.
KCNR 1460 AM. If we're not talking about it, it's probably not important. KCNR 1460 AM.
Yeah.
there you go. We've hit all genres today. We've gone from Merle Haggard to Ted Nugent. We haven't had any Weird Al. Yeah, that's Sounds like Elaine got disconnected. David Hook.
No, I didn't.
You're there.
I was hoping it wasn't.
Sorry.
I was hoping it wasn't my phone. I'm glad you caught it.
No, it was David.
Hey, Elaine, before we
answer David.
Oh, is David still on?
No.
No, David's gone. I want to make sure we talk about what was going on with the Yakima reservation and the visitors that they had and how that whole thing transpired.
Okay, I lived there for 16 years. I moved up in 92 to be their community development director in Toppenish, Washington. And at the time, Toppenish was one of the most visited destinations in Washington State because they have 75 magnificent murals on every building wall of the town. And the tourists from all over the world would come there to see real cowboys and real Indians and to take the covered wagon narrated tour around the murals, and Toppenish was thriving. And then the Yakima tribe got its, and mind you, that reservation is 80% Hispanic, a big farm area. It's 10% Indian and 10% Anglo. But it's nonetheless, it's a beautiful community where all those cultures grew up together and they never had problems with each other. They got along quite well. And then the Yakima tribe got its casino and put it right outside of town. And I had an office in downtown Toppenish, just two doors down from City Hall, and I used to love to hear the horse clopping on the streets when the tour was going by every 45 minutes. And those tours started reducing to, instead of every 45 minutes, is maybe twice a day and then maybe once a day. And then it became by appointment only because the casino was the big draw. And the tribal folks were shuttling people from the airport right directly to their casino. And the tourism industry pretty much dried up in downtown Toppenish. It sits like a little island, the municipality there, in the middle of an enormous reservation. And then the next thing to happen was our restaurants started closing down. Most of them did close down, and we intentionally frequented a couple of the favorite ones to keep them open as long as we could because they could not compete with the big all-you-can-eat buffets out of the casino. And then the retail, with no tourists, the retail shops started closing down, and the city of Toppenish has taken a huge economic hit. And as those buildings would empty out from an empty restaurant or an empty retail shop, the tribe would go in and buy that building or lease that space so that Toppenish could not regenerate its revenue. This process, that was my direct experience in Toppenish for 16 years. And I actually served on the city council there. I resigned before moving to Hobart. And I was part of a 7-member council. We saw this happening, and I was part of 7 members, and I said, we have to fight back. We have to do something here. And 2 of us on the council were adamant about that, but 5 didn't want to be called a racist, didn't want to make a problem, so they did and have done nothing. And the town is really deteriorating. It's really in serious economic decline. Likewise, that same tribe tried to capture 2 of the dams and shut the water off for the farming industry there years ago. I was a part of, fortunately, we defeated that process. But that's an example. When I say there are more non-Indians and towns and counties on reservations than there are Indians, but if you have a tribal government that has a triple-digit million-dollar annual budget and you're up against a little town with a single-digit million-dollar operating budget, guess who's going to overpower you?
Oh, yeah.
And then,
you're doomed.
Yeah, and you can't sue them. But if they sue you, then you can respond. But then the federal government, our taxpayers, pay for all their legal fees. And the local communities cannot afford those big legal fees to fight back. It's very, very hard. So it's just a very overpowering process now that has truly ramped up, and it's going to happen right here on the Flathead. Now that they control all the water and the power, there's 3 counties on this reservation that will go into immediate economic decline, and these towns, the reservation above us, the Blackfoot, they've already got 1 town up there talking about having to disincorporate or go bankrupt on that reservation. And that's happening across the country. And the problem with that is if your general purpose government, if your municipality or county goes down and you're a citizen of the state, you're then under the governance of a tribal member, a tribal government that does not allow you to go to the meetings. You can't run for office. You can't vote. And it's literally the whole, you know, you lose your representative government. And that's kind of the agenda, the big picture agenda. A lot of these reservations, they all want their land back. We were here first, you know. And so they use these terms like Aboriginal in my favorite, time immemorial. Those are terms that come out of United Nations and some Canadian things. Those are terms that don't do well in the legal courts in the United States. But those are the big new buzzers now. It's our Aboriginal land. We've had it since time immemorial. We were here first. Well, if that were the case, if they were here first, then there's no possibility for equality in the United States. They were here first. Everything else is secondary. You know, we didn't steal their land. Every bit of the ground was paid for, and through the Indian Claims Commission, some of the ground's been paid for 3 and 4 times, in addition to all the annual money they get. So the we were here first, you stole your land. Those are the little chants that they run around urban America and D.C. with when the reality is quite different. And this time immemorial, if time immemorial had any legal validity, there could not be a United States. They would trump everything.
Oh, yeah.
Now, what David was talking about, I've not read Mr. Nyquist's book, but it rings true with the stuff. When I thought I was out here in Montana to help fight a water war, in the research we've been doing to develop our legal case that we will be filing in D.C., in the research that we've done over the recent months, we've discovered that much of the language of Agenda 21 and Agenda 2030 has now been expressly incorporated into federal Indian policy. And if you look at the maps that are posted on the Agenda 21. I used to think those were the Tin Hat people, but I believe it now. If you look at the maps on Agenda 21 information sites, you'll see the North American continent, and you'll see that it no longer has states. And part of the game of taking down the states is using these tribal governments and Indian reservations as launch pads when they have the states so dependent upon federal funding. You know, the White House can pick up the phone to a governor and say, you do it our way or we're pulling your federal funds. These states are no longer acting like states. Montana is the worst. Montana has absolutely abandoned its people in 11 counties. Absolutely outright abandoned them. But Washington State, look at poor Washington State, 31 tribes in that state. Look at Oregon. And the one state that is still acting like a state is Idaho. I was just up there with some good people in Idaho and was able to meet with the leadership of their Idaho legislature, who are really looking at this and fighting hard as a state. But Montana is gone. The corruption in this state is profound. And the appeasement in this state is profound. Most of these northwestern states are not acting like states. That's why I so deeply believe in Ken Ivory and the American Lands Council. They're doing what they can to strengthen their states and fight back against this federal stuff. It's not the British coming anymore. It's our own federal government coming after our water, our energy, our crop production, the natural resources, the mining and uranium. They're coming after all of it out here. And the states are just going, oh, okay, oh, well. And the taxpayer is left picking up, you know, what the feds and tribes take away has to be offset by the remaining taxpayers in every state. And our taxes are going off the charts.
Well,
and our utilities are going off the charts.
And for those folks that that haven't looked yet, I think you ought to go to the citizensalliance.org. Do you guys...
If I could correct you, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but it's citizensequalrightsalliance.com now. We recently upgraded our website, and it's now citizensequalrightsalliance.com.
Oh, I better update stuff. I'm looking at the journal.
I should have mentioned that.
But this is an old copy, although I thought it was the one you sent to us, and I really liked the whole thing, actually. But it was...
It's an old but timeless piece, and it was printed before we just upgraded our website just a few months ago. And so it's now CitizensEqualRightsAlliance.com.
And
but I think maybe the old website might take you there.
It totally does. So CitizensAlliance.org take you there because
I posted off of it.
Yeah.
Oh, good. And we patched that piece. Good.
It says, because okay. This one part here says, in legal affairs, the latter takes precedence over the earlier. A latter law takes precedence over an earlier law. An amendment to the Constitution takes precedence over the original Constitution. Okay, so we all know that's true. And so it ties into this. A latter status of citizenship takes precedence over an earlier citizenship status. It could not be otherwise, or countries would be locked into an increasingly distant past, unable to adapt to either the present or the future. While tribal governments existed in this country before our Constitution, so did many other groups, including Native Hawaiians, Hispanics, French, Spanish, Dutch, and English. For example, white European males certainly also had governments in this country that predate the Constitution. While all this is true, it's also meaningless because the development of our country with its Constitution and citizenship essentially rendered these pre-existing statuses irrelevant, making a special exception to this general rule for one group of people isn't functioning according to the law. It's functioning in violation of it. Indians, like all humans, do have a valid pre-existing inherent right, as explained in the Declaration of Independence and guaranteed in the Constitution. As individual American citizens, these rights should be recognized fully and equally by our government. So by making themselves separate, they actually cause themselves not to be covered by the Constitution. It is the ruling document for the country, and I can hear everybody going, unless Obama's reading it, and okay, I'm with you, I get it.
That's thank you, Communist John Collier back in 1934. He's the one that twisted it backwards on that. But that's an excellent journal article that our top brains in our organization put together, and it is still timeless until we find some solutions. That's still the way it is.
It's just one of those things that I think people don't think about. I mean, they do. You know, it's funny. We have these conversations all the time. I just did this the other day. Someone said, well, how long do we owe a group of people special consideration? I mean, how long do they get to be more special than everyone else? And when does equality actually kick in? We have to take a really quick break on that cheerful note. We'll be... right back with you. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Oh, I like this song.
Oh, give me land, lots of land under starry skies above. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide open country that I love. Don't fence me in. Let me be by myself in the evening breeze. Listen to the murmur of the cottonwood trees. Send me off forever, but I ask you please, don't fence me in, just turn.
You're listening to We the People on AM 1460 KCNR.
If you are running your own business, you already know that if there are 1,000 items on your to-do list, you really have 3,000 things to get done. Success in business is in the details. You need help. Let the smart professionals at Five Star Bank help you take care of those financial details. Yes, smart people doing good business. Life is 10% of what happens to us and 90% of how we react to it. Be positive. Those at the top of the mountain did not fall there. Visit us at Five Star Bank and let us show you how we specialize in emerging business and commercial real estate. Five Star Bank also specializes in hard work, working hard for those that believe that success is just on the other side of the next opportunity. Thomas Jefferson was a great believer in opportunity, for he found that the harder he worked, the more he had of it. Your time is as valuable as your success. So visit us at Five Star Bank, 358 Hartnell in Reading, or call Eric Woodstrom at 223-6652. Online at fivestarbank.com. Five Star Bank, professional, progressive, and personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
NorCal Limousine Services is a family-owned business right here in Reading. We offer beautiful limousines and sedans with rates starting as low as $55 per hour. Do you have kids? We have amazing birthday packages for as low as $150.
Sure, they can jump around all day or enjoy a memorable birthday they will talk about for years to come with NorCal Limousine. Driving to any of the major airports from Reading can be a drag. Ride with us in style and avoid the long drive and parking fees. We service the Sacramento and San Francisco airports as well as all the cruise lines.
Hello, my name is Jamie, the owner of NorCal Limousine, and I have over 14 years in experience in the limousine industry. I know how to treat you right and will always be discreet. If you have never rented a limo before, you should give us a call at 276-8851. It's more affordable than you think and a whole lot more fun than driving yourself.
Like our Facebook, check out our Yelp reviews, and mention KCNR for additional savings. That's NorCal Limousine at 276-8851 or NorCalLimo.com. TCP 31143.
KCNR, 1460 AM, the most local programming in Northern California.
You own whatever land you land on. The earth is just a dead thing you can claim. But I know every rock and tree and creature has a life, has a spirit, has a name. Think the only people who are people are the people who look and think like you. But if you walk the footsteps of a stranger, you learn things you never knew, you never knew. Have you ever heard a wolf cry to the blue?
Going to sing about wolves. We've got to cut this song off.
Yeah,
it's a terrible song. I liked it for a minute. Now it's over.
Yeah, I'm all into Pocahontas and everything, but we don't need the wolves.
Yeah, it's from Pocahontas, by the way, just for all those people who didn't know that was Pocahontas. I didn't know it was Pocahontas.
It was Vanessa Williams singing on the soundtrack of Pocahontas.
Bob, you smoked this again. No pun intended. Oh, my gosh. All right, so Elaine, we're like, dang, we've got like 15 minutes left.
Well,
we've missed like tons of stuff.
They're probably just overloaded.
No, there's just a ton of stuff we didn't do yet, so I'm panicking.
I know. But there are two big pieces that are currently in play under this administration that are piling on to all that we've already talked about. And one is that the Obama administration has decided that energy is good economic development for tribal governments. And so billions are going out to tribes across the country to acquire major public utilities. And that was a part of the compact here, the Kerr Dam here in Montana, big Kerr Dam, part of the Columbia River system. It's also a Black Stark Dam, meaning that if power went out in the whole Northwest, that dam can restart itself and then power up some others. That dam was just given to the Salish Kootenai tribe. It was a public utility. It is now a tribal sovereign asset. They have no duty to keep the country safe. They have no duty to non-members. And they have a big dam. And that's the precedent. That's going to happen with dams. Remember I said back in 1921, the Secretary of Interior said all your dams and nuclear, all your energy sites needed to be on and near Indian reservations. Well, today they are. And it's long after September 11th, 2001. You know, when the Twin Towers fell, the biggest worry of the federal government was the grid system and the power. And so here we go. The second piece that Obama has implemented and Congress benignly consented to is that American businesses are a little reluctant to go on to to do business with tribal governments. Many of them have been burned. If they don't pay you, you can't sue them. And so American businesses are a little reluctant to go on to Indian or do direct business with tribal governments, other than vendors that supply some of their things. So Obama has decided that the big Middle Eastern money is good Indian economic development. And so in a HEARTH Act, H-E-A-R-T-H Act, HEARTH Act of 2012, the executive branch and Congress have now authorized Indian tribes to lease their private trust land. This is private trust land where state and county and local law enforcement eyes can't even look. They can long-term lease for up to 75 years their Indian trust land to Middle Eastern countries for purposes of economic development. Well, let's look at 340 reservations across the country, most of which have these private trust lands. And now the Middle Eastern company, Turkey in particular, this tribe, the Salish Kootenai tribe, has been engaged with Turkey in leadership exchanges and student exchanges. Turkey's going to come over here and build housing for the poor Indians. It begs the question, how's the housing in Turkey? But they're going to come over here and build, quote-unquote, housing for the Indians. So we're going to have these Middle Eastern folks who believe in a different religion. We're going to have little Sharia enclaves on Indian reservations right next to your major power and grid.
Wow.
And that is chilling. Absolutely chilling.
Well,
and
that's
that has a lot of the tribal members quite frightened themselves.
Well, look at the Yakima tribe. I mean, look at what's bordering their nation. We could talk a little bit about that.
Yes, it was really funny because when I wrote the book back in 2005, that was just 3 or 4 years after 9/11, and I was doing the book just following the road trip, and when my editor read the Homeland Insecurity chapter about what happened at the Yakima, he said, you have to make this chapter one. And so Homeland Insecurity is chapter one. Now, this goes back to 2005. As I said earlier, I had a little office in downtown Toppenish, and our home was upstairs above it. And on a Sunday afternoon, I got a knock on the door downstairs at my office, and it was a tribal member I had never seen before, and he just handed me four pieces of paper. And he says, this was on our radio station, Fax. I thought you should see it. And I looked at it, and it was a list of visiting journalists from a range of countries. Visiting journalists. They were out there in the middle of nowhere on the Yakima Reservation to visit their little radio station, which was maybe a 12 by 12 rented space with some hokey equipment. And they were there to visit the Yakima newspaper, which is a very good tribal newspaper. But it begged the question, these four pages were journalists from Yemen, Saudi Arabia, Tunisia. They were from all these Middle Eastern countries. And, you know, the tribe even took a photograph, and it was in the Toppenish Review newspaper, of these visiting journalists that just didn't mention the countries they were from. Well, the Big Yakima Reservation is surrounded on the north by Grand Coulee Dam, on the east by Hanford Nuclear Plant, across the Columbia River on the south by the Umatilla Chemical Weapons Storage Facility, and on the west by the Yakima Firing Center, which trains our troops to go to serve in the Middle East. So what were all these Middle Eastern journalists doing visiting the radio station?
Well, that's what I was going to ask. I mean, they obviously
really
knew that all that stuff was there. And how did the tribe feel about that? Was there any?
Well, they were literally boasting of it because they had an article and a photograph in the local newspaper, but they didn't identify what country these visiting journalists were from. They didn't identify them by name or country, but the four pages the tribal member handed me had the names and country. I happened to be teaching in the Tri-Cities area of Washington State, at Kennewick, in the Masters in Public Administration, and I had a lot of students that, adult students that worked for Hanford were my students, and one of them headed up security. So I took those four pages with me, and before class I said, I need to show you this. This needs to go somewhere, you know. And the darling little woman, she's a top security official at Hanford, but she looked like Mrs. Beasley. She was. You know, you talk about a cover. No one would ever suspect her of being in charge. In any event, she took the four pages and she says, don't you worry, my dear, this will get where it needs to go. And I no doubt she did, you know. But that was 10 years ago. That was before they are now congressionally authorized to bring these folks in as of 2012. You know, so we have, that's why I wrote that article, The Spreading Epidemic of Tribalism in America, because it's no longer just Native American domestic tribalism. We're going to be commingling it with Middle Eastern tribalism. And the goal is to take down states. Just take down states. and take down property rights and take down citizen rights and dismantle this country. And it's on steroids right now. But it is such, you never hear these conversations or news in mainstream media. You don't even hear it too much on other social media and things, because this is the best kept secret. This is federal Indian policy. That the only the tribal members and bureaucrats talk about it. And most people live in New York or L.A. or Sacramento, and why would you worry? When I lived in Southern California, I knew nothing about this stuff. Why would I?
Well, what we see out here, too.
It affects everybody now.
Well, in our area, the other thing that kind of woke me up to some of this, just I deal with it at work, but the one thing that we're seeing is the NGOs, all of the Center for Biological Diversity and the Defenders of Wildlife and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. All those guys, man, they're in thick as thieves with the tribes. And in some cases, they are the tribe. I mean, they're basically a phony tribe, because none of them are actually Native Americans, but they've got themselves labeled as a tribe. And so they get to push their environmental policy using tax dollars with the clout of somebody who operates outside the Constitution. It's it's a bad deal for the regular guys.
Well, it is, and it's a really rough deal for the tribal members. It isn't the tribal members at large or, you know, as a whole that are pushing this. It is a few tribal leaders who are just totally focused on getting as much money as they can, buying as much land as they can, and getting as much jurisdictional authority as they can, and that fits with the NGOs you're speaking of, and that fits with the United Nations and Agenda 21 stuff, and it certainly fits with what President Obama is up to with the states.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's
quite a triumvirate. It's quite a little combo that is bearing down on these states.
Yeah, people are all worried that we're going to have UN police or something like that, and it's like, hey, by the way, that's not who you should actually be worried about. You ought to worry about the guys that are actually here. We need to take one more quick break, and we're going to come back with Elaine and finish off the top of the hour. So, Elaine, we won't ask you anything when we come back. We'll let you do all the talking. Since we've got to cram it all in the last few minutes. So I hope that our listeners will go to the website, wethepeopleradio.us, click on Elaine's information and book and all that, and it'll blow your mind. There's a lot more than what we've talked about.
Put Geronimo in jail down south, where it couldn't look the gift horse in the mouth. Sergeant, Sergeant, don't you feel something wrong with your automobile? Warden, Warden, listen to me. Be brave and set Geronimo free. Governor, Governor, isn't it strange? You never see a car on the Indian range.
You're listening to We the People Radio, what else, on AM 1460 KCNR.
Kyle DeFore from Mighty Fine Foods in Bella Vista here. We'd like to thank our local community for making 2015 our best year yet. Your continued patronage supports 20 local jobs, and when you shop at Mighty Fine, your money stays in your community the way it should be. Daily deli specials under $5, a different hot soup served daily, groceries, meat, produce, and over 1,000 cold drinks. Mighty Fine Foods is your locally owned and operated neighborhood grocer. Mighty Fine, $2.99 in Deschutes in beautiful Bella Vista.
In the 40s, Redding Cab and Yellow Cab merged, and Redding Yellow Cab was born. A lot has changed since then. The town has more than tripled in size, and so have they. Through the decades, they've served Redding with generations of trustworthy drivers, family men and women, treating their customers with the respect and professionalism they'd expect for their own families. When you need to get to or from the airport or the train station, perhaps, Redding Yellow Cab is there for you. When you need a safe ride home, need to do some shopping, or want someone to shop for you, call Redding Yellow Cab at 222-1234.
Hello, Shasta County. This is Kurt Largent from Sheldon Largent Realty, and these are difficult times in our economy. It's difficult times in real estate, and people have lots of questions. Should I sell? Am I upside down? What is a short sale? What's cash for keys? What do I do if my house is sold on the courthouse steps? For answers to these questions and many more, please tune in Saturday from 9 to 10 here on KCNR 1460 AM to the Kurt Largent Radio Show. We talk about all things real estate.
Brought to you by Trinity Pest Control, Giles Insurance, and Summit Funding.
National news with a local view. KCNR, 1460 AM.
Now the Indians dressing up like cowboys. And the cowboys are putting leather and turquoise on. And the music is sold by law. And the fools who fiddled in the middle of the station are gone.
Amen to that. That's where the Irish and the Indians have it all over. All over the other guys. So,
you folks find some wild music.
Okay, hi. How about Geronimo's Cadillac? That was funny.
You know, as a little girl, my great-grandfather used to tell stories about seeing Geronimo in jail. And then as I learned more about American history, I just had such a childhood affection for Geronimo. And so hearing that song just triggered a lot of memories. We're a country that has learned by skinning our knees. We have not done everything right. And no other country has either. And we've got more opportunities for American Indians. What troubles me is that we have cultures that preserve themselves because it's the right thing to do. The Amish is a good example, and the Hispanic and the black culture. There are cultures that do not demand federal funding to preserve their culture because they do it out of their heart. They want to. And I think that's one of the things that's tarnishing our attitudes about American Indians. They used to be they were self-sufficient, but now they've got a very different role to play in this country, which is more of an entitlement mentality and a demand mentality, and you have to fund us for the rest of your lives because we were here first. Well, you know, we're all indentured servants to this really, really terrible system that's taking us down. It's combining with other pieces that are taking us down. And it's never benefited tribal families. I mean, if you go across any of the Indian reservations or drive through the neighborhoods, you would understand it's decades of poverty in spite of the trillions that have gone out.
You know, that's something I've noticed, and I really don't understand that. It's so visible. You go to these casinos on these reservations, and I mean, you know, they're raking in millions of dollars, and yet when you look at the reservation and how the people are living, I would think that'd be their first priority is to provide some decent housing and take care of their people.
You know what they do? And to me, this is just insidious. Many of the tribal governments and tribal cultures believe in the seven generations. And they say to their tribal members, you have to sacrifice because we have to use this money to buy land and to do things for the next seven generations. And they do this seven generations mantra. So the tribal members are being unfaithful to their government if they make too many demands because all that money is needed for seven generations. Well, it would be like me telling my granddaughter, I can't buy you shoes, I can't do this because I have to save money for the next seven generations. That is such, you know, that is just, that's just mean. That's just mean.
It is.
But that's part of the pablum that the tribal members swallow.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
And it's a part of their spiritual process that it also keeps them locked into the poverty.
Well,
it's their duty to let the tribal government spend all the money on land and politicians and everything else, but not them.
Well, I think exposing this, you're in a very, very small group of people doing something really important. Thanks a million, Elaine. We're out of time for today. But I really do hope folks will pick up your book, Going to Pieces, The Dismantling of the United States of America, and check out the Citizens Alliance, Citizens Equal Rights Alliance website. It's fabulous. You can find it all at wethepeopleradio.us. Thanks, Elaine. Next week we're talking
Thank you, Aaron and Bill and Bob. Thank all of you.
Thanks for being on.
Thanks a lot.
Appreciate the opportunity.
We're going to politics next week, folks, so we'll be talking about Iowa and all that stuff and what it means, and I think you'll like it. It'll be fun. Thanks, everybody. See you next week. WeThePeopleRadio.us.
KCNR, Shasta Redding.
Prices in the last 2 weeks.
Gasoline prices fell substantially in the past 2 weeks, down 14 cents. The new average for regular at retail is $1.91, and it's the low.